Okay, my exercise for us tonight as our theological class is this. I'd like you to think of some notorious. What do I mean by notorious? What is notorious? Noteworthy. Maybe we'll add the word notorious and perhaps infamous characters of the Bible that God used to positively influence his people. Notorious and infamous characters of the Bible that God used to influence and positively help his people.
I would like to.
Well, okay, just that. God uses that for their good. God uses notorious and infamous characters of the Bible to actually bring about the good of his people. How's that? Nebuchadnezzar, was he notorious and infamous? Yeah, what did he want to do? He wanted to have the whole world worship him, and that included these pesky little Jews that he had gone and captured in Jerusalem around 600 B.C., and, of course, we know that there were three that wouldn't bow the knee, right? Their names are? You're a girl after my own heart in that one, right? Because the idea, they're Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, everybody knows that. Their Hebrew names were Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael. But God uses Nebuchadnezzar to actually become a good in the life of Israel, and so in the life of the Jews. You have another one? Yeah, I just want us to mention them by name. I have a method to my madness or a madness to my method. I just want trying to, who do we see? Yes. Oh, you did one. Keep your hand down. How about, you have one?
Yeah, Xerxes.
Xerxes, okay. He allowed the Jews to come back into the promised land. Here's this Persian king that may not otherwise have had any reason to do anything good for these Jews, but he allows them to go back and begin rebuilding under a man by Zerubbabel.
King David.
Well, okay.
He's extremely notorious.
Well, notorious, but I'm also infamous. We wouldn't consider him infamous, right? We use the good word over here, nefarious, right? That's kind of what I'm looking for. Yes, sir?
Pharaoh.
I mean, come on. He's like the king of kings of the nefarious people, right? He wanted to destroy God's people, and God actually used him to bring about the Exodus, the whole picture of what God would do for us on a spiritual level. Someone else?
Herod.
When we could mention several different Herods, but Herod the Great actually wanted to see who put to death. Jesus, okay? So, but God uses that so that he would send Joseph and Mary where? To Egypt to fulfill a prophecy from the book of Hosea that said, out of Egypt I will call my son. And he fulfills that prophecy. And of course, there's other things that went with that. Yes, sir? Pilate. Pontius Pilate. Yeah, that's, you know, it's interesting. We name our kids John. We name our kids Peter. We name our kids all sorts of, after all sorts of Bible characters. We have a Zechariah and a Nicodemus. I've never seen anybody in the church come to me, I want to name my kid Pontius Pilate. That's how infamous and nefarious that one is, because he just, he was kind of an interesting character who basically allowed Jesus to be crucified. And yet, that was for the good of God's people. Again, we're trying to ask the question, what are some Bible characters who are infamous and nefarious that God uses to bring about actual good for his people? Saul, which one?
Saul.
King Saul or Paul Saul? Okay, Paul Saul. Yeah, I mean, now this one, that's kind of an interesting one, right? Because Saul, hell-bent on really destroying the early Christians. He was on the way to murder or imprison them, and he definitely was not well received by the church. And even after his conversion, what was everybody thinking? This is a trick. This is a trap. We're not going to fall for this. But that one, maybe along with Nebuchadnezzar, somebody who was just obviously Paul, gloriously transformed, used by God, not only for the good of the church, but obviously for Paul's eternal well-being. Can you think of some others?
Caesar.
Which one? All of them, okay? We're going to talk about some of them. Caesar Augustus, about to fill his own pocket, says, hey, I'm going to have a census, and I'm going to send everybody. You got to go to your own hometown and register, which actually gets a man by the name of Joseph, who was pledged to be married to Mary, back to his hometown. Where was Joseph before? Nazareth. Where was he supposed to get to? Bethlehem. How would he would have had no incentive to go, and God uses this desire of a pagan Caesar to push about or bring about the very birthplace that had been prophesied for his son, the Son of God, who would be born according to Micah, the book of prophet Micah, in Bethlehem, Micah 5:2. So can you think of some others? We can go on and on, right? Judas. Now, how did he bring about good for God's people? Well, he betrayed Jesus, okay? And that, I mean, he's fulfilling prophecy in all of that. So what I want you to see with this is not uncommon. It is absolutely not uncommon for God to use infamous, nefarious persons who desire more than anything else to actually squash God's people to actually help God's people. You got another one.
This one's not even in the Bible, though.
Well, don't go there yet. I didn't ask. You got to stay within the confines of my question. Okay, you, so far you have an A in my class, but okay. Okay. I mean, see what you're doing now? You're starting to think. You're thinking about all these Bible stories and all these Bible characters, and you're seeing how God has always used unbelievers, pagans, those sometimes bent on the destruction of God's people to actually bring about the well-being of God's people. So now I want to bring that idea into our church history lesson, because why would God stop doing that? We see God continuing to do that throughout church history. We've looked at some of the different Roman emperors. Last time we talked about the Rome in the 3rd century crisis, and I'm sure you all are just fascinated by all of those details, but Trajan and others brought about some persecutions on the church. Excuse me, it chokes me up. Brought some persecutions on the church. One of the things that was interesting about those early persecutions, while they were very intense, they were short-lived. And one of the things the church kind of early church recognizes, hey, if you mess with God's people, God's going to get you, if you remember kind of that scenario. Rome went into a civil war because everything was beginning to decline. Remember, we had pressures on the Roman Empire those invading or those peoples that lived outside the Roman Empire were tired of Rome, and they're trying to push into Rome and try to take back some of their lands. And so some of that got blamed on the Christians, and so that was the result of some of their persecutions. But the empire began to kind of implode. It was losing ground. It was losing prestige. And then in 284, an emperor came up by the name of Diocletian. And what's interesting about him, and this is the one that we're not going to be seeing a video about, but during the civil wars of Rome that were taking place between late 100s to the early 300 AD, the average reign of a Caesar or an Augustus was 1 to 2 years. So you didn't want to be said, hey, Carrie, you want to be the next Caesar? Your average reign is 1 to 2 years. And you know what ends your reign? Assassination. You want the job? Chris? Peter? You'll take it, okay? So then that's what's going on through all this time. No one reigns for much more than 3 or 4 years at the max. Some reign for 3 to 6 months. Diocletian comes along, and he's a military genius, and he basically says, we got to get Rome back to its glory days. And so he comes up with this particular idea to establish, if you know your Roman history, called the Tetrarchy, which is he divided the kingdom up into four basic arenas, and he appointed first two Augustuses, which was the highest ranking people, over the east and the west. And he, Diocletian, would be over the east, and he, Maximinus, would be over the west. And then he appointed some of his own blood to be Caesar's. They broke everything up into four areas, and they basically said, okay, David, you're responsible for this area. You do whatever you got to do to keep this area safe from the invading forces, and the only one you got to answer to is me, Diocletian. Okay, because I'm Diocletian, and I'm God. You mess up God with God, guess what? I squash you like a bug. Okay, and then he made sure there was an alliance via marriage to deal with that. And so he broke it up into four areas, and then that way they could all take care of their regions, and Rome began to excel. And Diocletian would reign for over 20 years, which I know we've had people reign longer than that, but he was not a young man when he started this. He actually retired at 305 B.C., and he tried to hand the reins off to someone else, and then everything began to implode again, which gave rise to the person we're going to talk about tonight, and that's a man by the name of Constantine, who would actually be the first to bring in a positive Christian influence into the church. You know, historians debate whether what Constantine did for the church was good or bad, but we do know that we can trace so much of the well-being of the church back to this man, Constantine. He was responsible for some of the most significant of our councils, the Nicene Creed, which would well define the very person of Jesus Christ as fully God, fully man, articulate all of that. So when we start talking about Jesus as fully God and fully man, and we use some of the arguments we're using, we're going back to what theologians around 300 AD had hashed out. And so it's kind of an amazing thing. So we're just trying to get ourselves there. But Diocletian, I just want to give you this one thing, because we're going to move from Diocletian to Constantine. From Diocletian, who was probably one of the most pagan of the Roman emperors, who could not tolerate not simply Christianity, but anything that put itself up against paganism. And therefore, he began some of the most severe persecutions against the church that the church ever experienced. And the thing is, were the previous persecutions only lasted about 18 months, these would last over a decade. So they're just, at some point you saw, okay, well, so God's going to intervene and this is all going to be done in about a year or so and we'll get back to the way things were. Well, it lasted for 10 years as this pagan man did not want to see anything Christian out in the open. And so we'll hear a little bit about that, I believe, as a summary. So this gives rise to the next emperor, the one that we'll talk about tonight, whose name is Constantine. And Constantine is converted. It seems that he genuinely came to know the Lord Jesus Christ. He still had it all mixed up with all sorts of his Roman background, but he really seemed to want to get things Christ-like in the church. Now, what's one thing that I think is interesting is that Diocletian set up this tetrarchy, these four areas, there were two what they called Augustuses. Those are the highest lords, gods. They were considered gods over two areas, east and the west. That was Diocletian himself and Maximinus in the west. Then he set up under Maximinus a man I got to pronounce his name correctly, Constantinius Chlorius. Constantinius Chlorius was the Caesar. Constantinius Chlorius, how many of you have heard of him? He married somebody by the name of Helena. Helena would become known as Saint Helena, who was the mother of Constantine. Why is that important? It's important for a lot of reasons, but Laura and I got to, I don't know if the word is appreciate, we saw the hand of St. Helena all over Israel. Because if you recall when we shared some of our pictures of Israel, St. Helena, because she evidently got converted with her son, and she said to her son, the emperor, can I go and find all of the holy sites and build a church over them? And so we find the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Who was responsible for that? Helena put a church on top of the what she believed to be the site of the tomb of Jesus and the birthplace of Jesus in Bethlehem. Build a church over the top of it. You know, what did she want to do? I think her desire was good. She wanted to kind of preserve these areas, but it's kind of hard. If you're trying to picture Golgotha and they put a church over this hill, I mean, how do you How do you envision all of this? And is that the right place? Because she just basically went around and said, hey, where do they say Jesus was crucified? Here, build a church. Where was he buried? Here, build a church. Where was he born? Here, build a church. Where was he baptized? Here, build a church. And she built these churches over everything. So, again, the influence that Constantine and even St. Helena would have on the church today, we went to Bethlehem and went into a church that was originally established by St. Helena back in 300 AD in order to preserve that site. So it's kind of interesting. Yes, ma'am. Dr. Reeves talks a little bit about it. I think we're talking about a 30-minute video, so he doesn't get into a lot of depth. There's a lot of split thought on what did Constantine become a Christian in order to just appease the masses and unite paganism and Christianity together so that they could be at peace. Some people believe that. Some believe that he was truly converted, and it's just like if I had lived in the world all my life and all I knew were the ways of the world and I got saved a week ago and I happened to come and say, hey, I'm going to be the pastor of the church, do you think I would bring in some bad thinking with my new faith? Yeah, it would take some time for me to begin to see some of the errors of my ways previously. I have to grow in the grace and knowledge of Jesus Christ. And so it's hard to say, was he saved and he just brought in some of his old influences, not realizing how bad they might be? Or was he just simply making a political statement and trying to unite Christianity and paganism? One of the false things is the thought that Constantine made Christianity the state religion of Rome. He did not. He basically allowed Christianity not to be considered a religion that couldn't be practiced and that would eventually lead to Christianity spreading throughout the entire Roman Empire and becoming kind of the state religion. But he didn't actually make a law, he couldn't, that said Christianity is the state religion. So we'll let the video at this point talk about this. Again, my whole point in bringing up some of the nefarious and notorious and infamous characters of the Bible is just to say that when we look at some of these pagan Roman emperors, or now perhaps a Christian Roman emperor, we recognize God has constantly been using people throughout history, sometimes good people, sometimes bad, to accomplish his purposes in the life of the church. And so talking about a more positive character, after Constantine, we're going to talk about a couple of things where we begin to move into what we call the Dark Ages and the Middle Ages, where there's not a lot going on. The church begins to get corrupt, which we actually see Constantine sets the stage for. Bishops used to be simply pastors. Now bishops are endued with some kind of political power. Well, you know, when you start getting some power, what do you do with it? You start using it to your own advantage, and it brings the corruption of the bishops into the church. And then we see that the Roman church begins to build off of that. And so popes and bishops and cardinals and all of them start to be influenced not by the word of God, but more by the political power and clout that they can wield, making deals and all of that. So we'll see all of that. So with all that said, let's consider, for our youth group, just because I know they'll appreciate this, I see what Cool Christian Dude has to say today for us. So I can't see your mouth, Matthew. Are you smirking?
Yes.
Okay. Cool Christian Dude on history, what has he got to say to us? We're going to talk about, I couldn't think of anything for Cool Christian Dude to say. He says, hey, let's talk about Constantine, okay? So here we go. Sometimes he's just a man, a few words, okay? So let's, with that, go to our video. What was that?
I like how slowly he
did. Yeah, it's dramatic. It's for effect. Okay.
It is 330 AD, and we are on the Bosporus. And the Bosporus is this small strip of land that connects the Black Sea to the Bosporus Sea, which then flows down into the Aegean Sea. And this strip of land in the ancient world provided a unique military advantage. If you were attacked by sea, you simply release your own fleet to defend the city. And those who would attack you by land have to come into the narrow strip and are funneled into a smaller strip of land. And the city that would eventually be built on it would have nearly impregnable walls, making it one of the most defensible cities in the ancient world, on into the Middle Ages. And it's 330, and Constantine, the new emperor of Rome, having united both East and West after the split between East and West under the Tetrarchy. And Constantine is walking with his entourage around the new city. Now, it had been an old city, but Constantine had decided, not long after coming to the throne and not long after uniting both East and West, that he wanted to found a new Rome. A new Rome that would rival the image and the mystique of the old classic Rome in the Italian peninsula. And in this year, 330, Constantine has arrived to dedicate the new city with most of the principal construction now finished and with the hope that the city would grow to dominate the Eastern Empire as the new imperial capital. And newer students of history always wonder about this. Why would Constantine leave Rome? Anyone who travels to Rome today, of course, is aware of the fact that Rome is filled with all of these relics, all of these artifacts from the ancient past. Places like the Pantheon or the Capitoline Hill where the Senate was once housed. But you have to remember that Rome was not as much of a big deal as it is to us today, at least not in terms of cultural memory. In Constantine's day, Rome and its glories were not all that distant from the past. Moreover, Rome was not in an ideal location to run the empire. The gravity of the empire, the central pull of it, was to the east. Out east, you had the principal economic structures. You had more wealth. You had more population density. You had more important cities to the ancient world. And the core of intellectuals, of artists, of serious thinkers, always at this time tended to come from the east. From a military standpoint, the east was more important as well. The major enemies that would plague the Roman Empire and that had plagued the Roman Empire for centuries were all out east. In particular, the Persian Empire was something that was always an enormous concern to the Roman imperial elites. They were concerned that if the Persian Empire was left alone for too long, if an eye was not kept on it, that the empire of Persia would rise up and would conquer or challenge the imperial state of Rome. And as Constantine is walking the limits of the city, and as he comes to the end of his tour, Constantine does something that no Roman emperor had done ever before. Constantine decides that he will enter Hagia Sophia, and he will attend a mass, a church service, part of the Christian liturgy. It is almost impossible to believe that in the centuries before this, even in the years before this, the decades before this, that any Roman emperor would ever participate in a church service at all. And yet here was Constantine, a Christian, and yet also emperor of Rome, having dedicated a new city, a new Rome, now giving thanks to God for that new city and for his conquest of the Roman Empire. Not thanking the gods, not thanking the pagan gods, not performing any ancient rituals of classic antiquity, but rather participating in the Christian liturgies that worshiped Christ as Lord and that said, once and for all, our God reigns and it is now part of the Roman Empire. This takeover by Constantine of the empire as a Christian signaled some of the most important changes that would shape not only the East, but also the West for centuries, if not even longer, all the way down until today. This is called the Constantinization of the Roman world. This is the Christian man now becoming the Roman emperor. And now that he is Roman emperor, now that he is in charge, now that he is sovereign, Constantine is now supporting the church. But there is no mistaking that when you go to New Rome in 330, that this is going to be a Christian imperial city. If in 330 you were to go to Old Rome, to the Rome of the Italian peninsula, you would actually find not much Christian influence there. You would find bishops and churches and clergymen now coming out from under the persecution. But what was still dominant in Rome and in much of the Roman imperial world was paganism. And so therefore, in 330, when Constantine is dedicating a city that seems to spring up from the soil out of nowhere, he is able to create an entirely Christian-focused city, a city that is dominated by Christian architecture, that is dominated not by one massive church, Hagia Sophia, but also by another one, Hagia Irene, Holy Peace. Peace and wisdom, these were now the two dominant churches of the Constantinian world. There would be no whispers to pagan gods thanking them for military prowess. In Constantinople, the city named after Constantine himself, the only god to be worshipped is Christ and the Trinity. We have to pick up where we left off in our last lecture. The Tetrarchy had arisen under Diocletian, and in the end, despite its initial successes, it was a failure in terms of keeping Rome stable and under a hereditary regime of passing off power from one Augustus to one Caesar and so on. And at one point, we said in the last lecture, there were as many as 6 or even 7 rival claimants to be Caesar or Augustus in all parts of the empire at large. One of the rivals in the early 300s was Constantine himself. Now, Constantine's father, Constantius Chlorus, had been the Caesar of the western half of the empire. Constantius Chlorus had ruled from Trier in northern Germany, and he had been quite adept at keeping order in his area. And he was such a success that when he was raised to the title of Augustus, he was largely hailed by the armies and by those in the western half of the empire. At one point, though, Constantius Chlorus goes up into Britain in order to put down a rebellion from the Picts, those who were in the modern-day area of Scotland. And Constantine went with his father. And yet, while there in Britain, Constantius Chlorus dies in the city of York. And despite the fact that Constantine was barred from the succession, despite the fact that he was not appointed to be the Caesar of the West, the army knew a good thing when they saw it, and the army always believed that the son of a general, if he had proved himself in battle, would be the next best thing. And so in York, Constantine is proclaimed to be the Augustus of the West. Now, this is a usurpation. This is a breakdown of the Tetrarchy. Constantine had been barred, had been excluded from the Tetrarchy, yet because of his prowess in battle and in leadership, and because he was the son of Constantius Chlorus, Constantine was hailed as the Augustus. Down in the Roman Peninsula, however, there was Maxentius. And by the time of 312, the only two claimants in the West are Constantine and Maxentius. And Constantine is going to seek to put all of the western half of the Roman Empire under his umbrella of authority. And so Constantine travels from the northern part of Germany up in Trier, and he travels down into the Italian peninsula, and then he and Maxentius' armies meet at the Battle of Milvian Bridge. And the Battle of the Milvian Bridge is one of the most important turning points in the Western world. Constantine was a superior tactician. He knew how to lure Maxentius out. And so when they got to the Milvian Bridge and he realized that Maxentius' army was there to meet Constantine's army, Constantine held back, he kept his troops under cover, held them back in a forest, and Maxentius was there to meet him, and he was lured over the bridge at one point. Now, they weren't simply on the concrete bridge itself. Maxentius' army had also built pontoons of boats down on the water. And the problem of this is just as Maxentius' army seeks to go across the bridge, Constantine's army unfurls itself, it strikes, and it meets Maxentius' army on the bridge. And of course, anytime you're in battle, if you're caught in a narrow strait, if you're caught in a narrow pass, and particularly if you're caught on a bridge like this, any strength in numbers, any strength in battle, any strength in tactics that you might have had now go out the window. And Constantine's armies push Maxentius back onto the bridge. And in the end, Maxentius falls off of the bridge down onto the pontoon bridge, the boat bridge down below, and that bridge collapses, and Maxentius drowns in the sea, leaving Constantine, now Emperor Augustus, over all of the West. Now, that story would be important on its own, except for what had happened the night before that battle. On October 28, 312, Constantine had a dream or a vision. It's a bit unclear in the evidence which is which, but in either case, Constantine had a vision of some kind of Christ. And we are told that Christ comes to Constantine and that he sees him and that he gives Constantine a symbol, a sign. And that sign is the Christogram, the Kairo. And that is, you take the name of Christ in Greek, which is Kairo, the first two letters. And you take the Kairo and you put them on top of each other. And you end up with this symbol, the Christogram, the Kairo, it's been called. And Christ, in this vision, tells Constantine to place the Kairo, the Christogram, onto his banner as he goes into battle, and that he will have success. Another version of the story says that Christ speaks to Constantine and shows him that if he puts this sign onto his banner as he marches into war with Maxentius, he is told in hoc signo vinces, which is Latin for by this sign conquer. In other words, the vision that Constantine has, the story that he tells his troops after the fact, is that he has seen the risen Lord Christ, that he has converted to the Christian faith, and that the God of Christianity has given him great success in battle. In fact, the symbol that Christ gives him now on the banner is now the thing that allowed Constantine to have success in battle against Maxentius. And so, at the Battle of Milvian Bridge, you now have a newly converted Constantine facing off against Maxentius, who is a pagan, who is, if he had won, would have continued the pagan practices of old Rome in the western half of the empire until he died or was killed himself. In other words, at the Battle of Milvian Bridge, because Constantine has converted, you now have a Christian versus a pagan. When Constantine wins, now the Christian emperor is in charge of the West. Now, the telling of this story is complicated by the fact that we don't have any contemporary accounts or eyewitness accounts of Constantine himself at the Battle of Milvian Bridge telling this story. The two accounts we have actually come from a great deal of time after the fact of the Battle of Milvian Bridge. In fact, they come from about the time when Constantine has come to unite both East and West. The first account we have is from Lactantius. Now, again, Lactantius was not there himself. He was actually off in the east when the Battle of Milvian Bridge occurred. And the story that he is telling, then, is gotten through secondhand accounts. Perhaps the more historically accurate account comes from Eusebius, who wrote a book called The Life of Constantine. And Eusebius tells us that he got the story from Constantine directly, that he had inquired of Constantine directly, and that Constantine had told him the story about his conversion before the Battle of Milvian Bridge. The problem here, though, is that Eusebius, by this point, when he is interviewing Constantine, is interviewing a Constantine who is actually a great deal older, who has been ruling for some time and whose Christian faith has matured, at least in some ways. And so it is hard to take Eusebius fully seriously because he is taking Constantine at his word. Still, there is no room for cynicism here. Some historians will go so far as to say that this did not happen, that this is a story made up by Christians after the fact to kind of baptize the Roman emperor Constantine as themselves. Some historians have tried to argue that Constantine had used a pagan symbol on his banner and that after the battle some Christians sort of snuck in and said, oh, Constantine, by the way, that's actually a Christian symbol, and had somehow convinced him otherwise after the fact. Well, that cynicism from historians is really unnecessary. For one, we actually now do have archaeological evidence that proves that Constantine knew what he was doing and that the Kairo, the Christogram, was actually on the banners. We do have archaeological evidence that Constantine had put this on his banners because within an immediate amount of time, a few short years afterwards, Constantine does in fact show on the coinage and on other artifacts and on other relics around this time that he had now put the Christogram on the banners, and we see this in the archaeological evidence. So even if the story that comes down to us from Lactantius and Eusebius is a bit embroidered, still there is no need to be cynical. The main reason, though, why it makes virtually no sense to believe that Constantine has either falsely converted, or as some have argued in the past, that he converted because, well, maybe there were a lot of Christians in the army, or maybe there were a lot of Christians in the populace of the West, and therefore Constantine sort of cynically adopts the Christian posture in order to rule and to galvanize the Western Empire behind him now that he has taken over after the defeat of Maxentius. But there really is not much evidence for this either. In fact, Christianity is still a profoundly minority faith at this point. During the Diocletian Revolution, for example, during the Diocletian persecutions of Christians, most of the Christian presence, both in the government and in the armies, was eviscerated. Diocletian, on multiple accounts, had called for any Christians in the army or in the noble houses to be removed. Now, that is evidence that there was some presence of Christians in these realms, but they were removed, at least in part. And, more importantly, there does not seem to be an overwhelming surge of Christians at both the lay level and at the government level. And so what Constantine is actually doing is taking on a faith that is the minority faith, that is the extreme minority faith. And this is not the faith that would galvanize just about anybody in the Western world. If anything, it runs quite contrary to the Western world. And we see the fact that it runs contrary to the Western world because of the way Constantine conducts his business and his policies after the Battle of Milvian Bridge. In 313, Constantine and Licinius get together in Milan, and they issue what's called the Edict of Milan. And this edict is often misunderstood. It's sometimes believed that the Edict of Milan makes Christianity the official religion of the Roman world. It doesn't do that. Rather, what the Edict of Milan does is it takes the Christian religion and it puts it into the status of a licit religion, a legal religion. Now, there were only a certain number of religions in the ancient world, of the Roman world, that were licit, that were allowed, that did not have state control or state persecution or oppression. Christianity had always been illicit. It had always been persecuted or oppressed or at least marginalized in Roman society because of its illicit status. But in 313, the Edict of Milan has to put the Christian faith into the category of the licit religion. It makes it one of the options in the Roman world. But what it doesn't do is allow Constantine to sort of shove Christianity down on top of all of the populace, which is still largely pagan. If you look at some of the coinage and some of the other cultural artifacts of this day, we still see lots of paganism on all of these elements of society. Historians have always pointed out that there were, for example, images of Constantine with the sun god on a coin. And they said in this that Constantine was some kind of amalgam of paganism and Christianity. Or they look at other factors in Constantine's life, of his personal morality, or sometimes the lack thereof. The fact that Constantine had one of his sons killed in a military coup. A lot of things that certainly don't point to a very Christian, saintly man. But again, all of these things are certainly problematic. But again, it is one thing to say that someone is a bad Christian or that they are not truly Christian in the way that they live their life out. But it is another thing to say that they have not converted or not at least somewhat sincere about their faith. So in other words, what we have with the conversion of Constantine is we have a Christian Constantine, a man who is at least seeking the Christian faith in some overt way, ruling over a Western province, over a Western part of the Roman Empire that is profoundly pagan. And so what Constantine is unable to do is churn the tide overnight. So instead, what Constantine does is he supports the Christian faith at first indirectly and then overtly. He supports it again. He does not force it upon the populace. He does not make it somehow the only official religion of the Roman Empire. That will happen at a later date with Constantine's successors. But at this point, all that Constantine can do is simply make the Christian religion a licit part of the faith and then support the Christian faith as the emperor himself. Okay, so let's ask the question now. If Constantine has come to the throne and he is a Christian, but he is also the Roman emperor, how does this change the church? And this question is usually handled in one of two ways by either historians or by the popular conception of this period. On the one hand, it's simply brushed over, the idea that Constantine has come to the throne and that the Roman world, the Roman Empire, has been merged now with the Christian faith. It's just seen as a nice, triumphal kind of manifest destiny of the Christian church. That what Constantine did was really not all that much. Really, all he did was simply add a level of stability to the church. On the other hand, though, there are those who simply recoil to see the mingling, the coming together of the political Roman Empire and the pacifist Christian faith, the Christian faith that had been the martyrs now being those who are in power and as the centuries wear on, become those who do the martyring or those who do the oppressing in some occasions. And without pitching the case too strongly on one side or the other, I do want to describe some of the ways that Constantine began to shape and change the church. Even those of us who are the most optimistic about what Constantine achieves during his reign and about the ways in which the Christian Roman Empire will move forward for the next several centuries and on into the medieval West and into the world of Byzantium. Still, Constantine coming to the throne does change things. The church after Constantine does not look like the same church, at least on the externals, as it did before. The church, for the first time under Constantine, has to deal with the problem of power, the problem of wealth, the problem of the relationship between Christian faithfulness in the church and public faithfulness in a world that is pluralistic and pagan. Well, we can talk about at least a few of the cosmetic changes right off the bat. First and foremost, the bishops of the church take on a new status in the Roman Empire now that they are a licit religion. Prior to Constantine, pagan priests and rulers, those who were really instrumental in the shaping of pagan identity, had certain legal rights that were unique to them. They were free of certain taxation. They were free of certain legal action against them. They had a privileged position, not always at the inner court of the emperor, but certainly on the wider orbit of the Roman world. With the power being of the emperor, the leaders of the pagan world were always at least on the periphery, at least moving towards the center of power. Well, with the coming of Constantine, the bishops begin to take these places. Now, they don't do it overnight. Again, the Constantinian Revolution is not so much a revolution as, say, the French Revolution, which seemed to change France overnight from a constituted monarchy to suddenly a republic of some kind. Rather, the Constantinian Revolution was really more piecemeal. Bishops began to make their way into the power structures simply by their relationship with Constantine. For example, in local cities, often the decurions, or those who were the elites out in the cities, would be those who would be called on to rule or to render verdicts in certain cases. Maybe they would be in charge of legal issues with settling a dispute in the local community. Under Constantine, increasingly, it is the bishops who begin to take on these roles. They have a certain power, a certain status, a certain dignity now in local communities. We also see changes in just simply the structure of the church itself. The Roman world had always compartmentalized its politics into what we call diocesan arrangements. That is to say, a ruler or a set of rulers would be in charge of a diocese in the Roman world, in the pagan Roman world. That diocese would be a regional governance. They would manage all of the affairs in this regional area. Well, lo and behold, after Constantine, suddenly the church takes on a diocesan formula. Now, there had always been bishops, but bishops prior to the coming of Constantine were more often in charge of their churches, and then by their role as a bishop is supposed to be, a pastor to the pastors, they would have regional influence and authority in a region that was connected to churches. In other words, it wasn't necessarily a strictly geographical region. We see bishops that are of a certain stature or of a certain dignity, those who are more learned, let's say, often sometimes extending their influence and rendering their opinion to churches in other areas that are not immediately under their subordination. In many ways, this is how the papacy begins to develop its own understanding of its authority. The Bishop of Rome, because he has a privileged position in the early church, begins increasingly in the West to offer his verdict or his opinion to dioceses around the Western world, and increasingly even into the Eastern world. After Constantine, though, the diocesan structure becomes more fixed. Suddenly we have bishops that are over a diocese, and they have regional jurisdiction over this area. Now, it is somewhat ambiguous, again, given Constantine's takeover of the state, where spiritual authority begins and where secular authority ends. Another factor that Constantine brings, it's a small one, but it is an important one, is that the church begins to take on a new architecture. Now, the church had always resisted using pagan temples or shrines and the architecture of these places as their own places of worship. We have virtually no evidence, for example, of churches with these strong Corinthian columns out front, mimicking a pagan architectural style. Instead, what the church begins to look more and more like, though, is the Roman Senate House, the Roman places of politics. We call this the Basilica. And a basilica is a long corridor building, usually with an entrance on one flat side, that goes all the way down to the end, and then on the far end you have a curved structure. And this is a basilica. Well, not surprisingly, if you've ever seen a basilica church or a cathedral church, very often, at least before the Gothic Renaissance and the High Middle Ages, these places would take on a basilica style of structure. Now, these may sound cosmetic, but they are important, at least in general. The church begins to look more and more political, more and more Roman. It takes on structures that were not natural to the church, structures that were straight out of pagan Rome. And so therefore, the question is only natural to ask, is this a sign that the church itself is changing? Now, initially, I think the answer is no. Just because Constantine is converted, you don't have mass conversion of the pagan world. You certainly don't have forced conversion. Still, over the course of Constantine's life and on beyond Constantine and his successors, all of whom were Christian except for one, Julian the Apostate, and even Julian reigned only for a short period of time and was, at least in general, largely unpopular. But after Constantine, what you begin to see is a more permeable barrier between the outside world and the church world. It's not a stretch to say that in order to become part of the influential circles of the Roman Empire, one needed to be Christian. It's not unlike certain parts of America over its earliest centuries, in which people had to be Christian in order to run for office. And as we all know, there have always been people who have feigned conversion or have feigned a certain faithfulness in their religious life in order to gain political favor. Well, that's not a 20th or 21st century invention. That is there all the way back to the beginning. That is there with Constantine. We do see people begin to come into the church who are certainly not those who would have been there during the age of persecution. Now, again, we don't have to see in this some great perversion of the church. We today who have churches that are permeable don't simply think the church has fallen to the wayside. We actually welcome unbelievers into our churches. We hope they come. We hope they seek out the faith or at least come and inquire. So it's not necessarily all that bad to have a church that is actually attracting people in some ways. But, of course, what is unique is the way in which Constantine has brought power to bear. And the clearest example of Constantine's somewhat ambiguous role in the church is the Council of Nicaea. Now, if you grew up in any kind of liturgical church, or if you grew up in a more traditional church, and increasingly even non-denominational or broadly evangelical churches are doing this, many of us grew up saying at some point the Nicene Creed during our services. Now, a couple of things to clarify. When we say the Nicene Creed in full, we are not actually saying the Nicene Creed itself. Rather, we are saying, historically, the Nicene-Constantinople Creed. The Nicene Creed itself, first and foremost, was only about the doctrines of Arianism. And Arianism was this belief that Jesus was somehow not fully God. I always tell students that the easiest way to understand Arianism is to draw a hard line and call this the creator-creature distinction. Above the line, you have God, and below it, you have everything else. Anything that is not God belongs on the bottom. Well, according to Arianism, at least technically, Christ is on the bottom. Now, Arianism will say that Christ is exalted, that he is the highest of creation, that he is something like God, that he has significantly more elements to him that are godlike or godly than any of us. He is elevated. But still, according to Arianism, Christ is on the other side of the line. He is not on the God side. He is not God himself. He is a creature made by God the Father. Well, the Council of Nicaea was summoned during Constantine's early reign to address this issue. And without going into the theological issues right now, we have to look at the issue in terms of the new situation that Constantine has brought. Now, the church had met dozens of times prior to Constantine. It always met in council form in order to deal with issues. This is not the first council that the church has ever called. There's something of a myth there that this is some new political idea that the church would meet in a council and impose its will on people. Well, if that's the case, then the book of Acts and the Jerusalem council is to be ignored, as well as the dozens of others between the Jerusalem council and the Council of Nicaea. But what is important to note about the Council of Nicaea is that situated in it, seated in it at times, is Constantine himself. Now, Nicaea is the first ecumenical council, we say. That is to say, it is the first attempt to bring all Christians or representatives from all of the areas of the church from around the known world to one meeting in order to discuss something. But seated there, the elephant in the room, is Constantine. Now, Constantine did not run the debate. He was not theologically in charge of anything. But still, what the Council of Nicaea brought was this new position of power. The Council of Nicaea, whatever its decisions on Arianism and other matters, now had with it the power of the Roman Empire. Now again, the church had power before. The church has the keys. It has the ability to bind and loose, to make decisions, to ratify, to say this is true according to scriptures, and this is either less true to the point of being false, or it is an outright lie. The church has always done this. But what is happening now is the decisions of the church are now being wrapped up into the political magisterium of Constantine himself. Now, Constantine holds back on this. This is an important thing to understand. Constantine himself does not bludgeon the Arians after the Nicene decision to reject the Arian understandings of Christ as a creature and not as God. Constantine does not scourge them. He does not destroy the Arians. In fact, in some ways, he leaves them be. And then for far too long, the Arian faith continues to flourish and develop into the Eastern and eventually into the Western world. Still, Constantine has power. And power brings with it a greater degree of seriousness whenever the church is meeting. And so there are a number of ways in which the conversion of Constantine, as it synced up with his takeover of the Roman establishment, brings change to the church. In fact, it is hard to even understand the church today and its ambiguous role in politics and its ambiguous understanding of power without looking back to the Constantinian world. Even with all these ambiguities and with all the problems that Constantine brought, for those who were there when Constantine converted, and suddenly the church went from being pretty ravaged by persecution to now being cherished by the one in charge, for them, this was little more than a miracle.
Okay, keeping you all awake. Some of you look pretty laid back. All right, what was that? Edge of your seat. So yeah, this is ripping stuff, isn't it? I think sometimes we don't appreciate the impact of things in the past upon our present. And again, there's a lot of different things with Constantine. Over my times of reading about him, in some things you're like going, yeah, this man was great. And other things you're going, man, this really messed up the church. But to recognize that some of the things that we deal with as a church today finds its roots right here. Here's one that maybe kind of got glossed over. How many of you know that churches are exempt from taxes in the United States? You know, there are people working to get that changed. They think that was just some kind of weird thing that the early founders of our country made up. Did you hear where the roots of that were found? All the way back in Roman paganism, where the clergy of those different religions were exempt from taxes. And when the true church, Christianity, was brought in as a licit religion, it was given that tax-free status. That's something that's been around not simply since the beginning of our country, but it's been the practice even before Constantine. This goes way back into the practice of the Roman Empire. And I think it even was founded in some of the Grecian Empire. So anyway, just some interesting things there. Why are things the way they are in the church today? We can point our fingers all the way back to this time when this man, obviously used by God, was he notorious, nefarious? Was he? We would say he's probably one of the good guys, at least in the sense that he did more to kind of allow Christianity to move ahead without threat. But sometimes even that kind of prosperity brings some things that we'd rather not see in the church. So let's see if I have a couple of other thoughts here. One thing. Why are there dioceses? If you're familiar with a Roman church or Episcopalian church, they have dioceses. Where did that all come from? wasn't founded biblical. The dioceses are not a biblical formation. It's just that these bishops, remember, the Roman Empire is divided up into these regional areas where they had secular authorities. When Constantine allowed the bishops to have a little more power and they began to creep into the secular areas, they simply began to take over the dioceses that were already there. And so if you're anything in the background of Roman Catholicism or Episcopalianism, you know that you have dioceses, and that none of that's biblical. It actually comes out of pagan Romanism. So kind of interesting thought there. No pope. You notice that? And all that we've talked about, who would have dared been a pope? Who could have been a pope before Constantine? I mean, nobody would have listened to any pope. In the Roman Catholicism, teaching the ongoing succession of the pope, of this vicar over the entire church, it started with Peter, and he's transferred that mantle through generations to our current pope. Absolutely no historical grounding in that. Obviously not biblical. There was no such thing as a pope. It wouldn't be until Constantine kind of gives these bishops a little more secular authority that we're beginning to see them use that, and there's going to be a time when a pope is going to kind of emerge, and so we'll see some of that. So are there some thoughts, comments, questions from some of you? It's clear as mud, exciting as all get out. What? Yeah, 325 in the Council of Nicaea. That is a very significant date. It's 330 when he actually finished Constantinople, and that's what at the beginning of the video I don't know what the significance of that is. Only that it is interesting. He didn't want Rome to be the seat of power. He wanted to build his own city, and he built Constantinople, which is called what today? Istanbul. Okay, so Constantinople and Istanbul are the same thing. Why did he want to build his city there? Why did he want to build the seat of power there at the top of Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey? What was significant about that? So maybe from a biblical perspective, he's recognizing seven churches of Asia Minor, these pretty powerhouse churches up to a certain point. Yes, sir? Okay. Is in a strategic location. You know, it's interesting because they don't really talk about, but the artists and the philosophers, where's Greece in relationship to Constantinople? Just across the strait and down and head south a little bit, and there you are in Athens or Corinth, and these were seats of tremendous philosophical and educational centers. They were just, that's the place that you want. So then he's surrounding himself with all of these things. So again, the significant date that I was giving is really 325 AD. It's called the first Council of Nicaea, sometimes called the Nicene Constantinople Council, because that is, and again, amazing thing. No Roman emperor would have ever dared enter into a church. Here is Constantine entering into a church. And I find this a little fascinating about the man. He calls his council together, figure out this problem with Arianism. We need to know what's biblical, which basically classified Jesus as a created being. Do we have a modern day religion that goes door to door telling us that Jesus was a created being? Jehovah's Witness. It's just a form of Arianism. And what's remarkable about that is not only did he get all of these theologians and pastors together to discuss it, but he sat in on the meetings. And he didn't sit there to say, this is what I think. He seemed to be very humble and simply listened to the discussions and waiting to see what the outcome would be. So, I'm with you. And I don't know. I mean, and he said these things are problematic. This is my guess, and I am by no means a learned person when it comes to Roman emperors and all of the background, and we're trying to figure out how can he be a Christian, or is he a Christian, and doing these things. But again, I do think you have somebody who was brought up in a very Roman pagan way, who is converted, evidently at 312, but who's teaching him? I mean, It's not like he can't call up John MacArthur and say, can you kind of give me some direction on what's right and what's wrong? We would hope, we would think, okay, come on, you've been a Christian for 10 years, you kind of should know that this is wrong. I don't know how to answer that question. He obviously, was it because of political pressure? Was it because he was still hanging on to vestiges? This is what Romans did. The Roman emperors were notorious for doing these kinds of things. And so is he just doing what he's used to? I don't know how to give you an answer. I don't have a satisfying answer, so I'm not going to satisfy you. Unless you're satisfied with my unsatisfactory answer. Okay, so yes, sir. Yeah, of course, the problem with the theory is that Christianity was such a minority religion that how were you going to unite Christianity? How were you going to use this minority religion to unite an entire empire? That's the argument against that. And yet, one thing we do see, if you read a little bit deeper, you find that Constantine kind of brought in, he did bring in pagan ideas into the church because that's what he knew. And I think that that did provide kind of a framework for pagans and Christians to now kind of come together. And it did. Now, he was clear, and this is true, he didn't. The masses of pagans were not instantly converted when Constantine opened the doors. But permeable, I guess he used the word that, you know, you can come in. We want the sinners to come in. But they did start to come in. And some of them would have influence and power in their realms. And so how much did that mess with the church's identity? We don't know. He did say the church would never look the same, right? The church before Constantine looked different than the church after Constantine, and there's no denying that fact. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, well, again, there's a couple of things. We think of Rome as, this is the center of all things, right? And he did make mention that Rome wasn't as big of a deal at that time as it is to us now. I mean, there's still, we see the significance of Rome prior to Constantine, but at that point it was not, okay, it's just this Rome, and Rome will continue to have a huge influence in history after Constantine, so we kind of get this, we make more of Rome than Constantine would have. It'd be just kind of like saying, hey, I want my own place, you know, I don't know even what to compare it to. People over in Dallas say, forget this, let's go over to Fort Worth and build up a big city here, you know, because we don't want to be in Dallas anymore. So they just move everything over and establish what they wanted to. Now, what is interesting, one of the things Constantine did is try to establish Constantinople as uniquely Christian, architecturally, by way of arts and all of that, and he couldn't have done that in Rome. And so, because Rome was so thoroughly pagan at that point, we like to think again of by the time we get to Martin Luther, and Martin Luther goes to Rome, Rome is thoroughly, if I can say this word with a little c, Christianized. I mean, now you've got Christians running everywhere, maybe not very good Christians, and some may be only Christian by, you know, name, but not by true identity. That's the way we tend to picture Rome. That's not Rome at the time of Constantine. This is a pagan place, orgies, things like that going on. You saw some of those pictures and stuff going on, and it could be that Constantine, this new convert, is trying to separate himself from some of those influences and built Constantinople in order to accomplish some of that. So again, we don't know all of these reasons. Our resources are limited. So, any other thoughts? Well, it's not a pagan symbol. It's all two Greek letters, chi, which we would call letter X. It's Christos is chi, rho, omicron, sigma, tau, omicron. Sigma, those are the Greek letters, and so they took the first two letters, chi and rho, and then just did that symbol. I don't know. I don't know how to take that. I'm surprised Reeve said this. It's like the question is, was this a dream or a vision? The idea of if it was a vision, it was from God. That gets kind of squirrely to me because now we're talking about some kind of extra biblical revelation. You know, did God give him a dream? I can't judge this, but it seems to me he might have had some kind of, he had bad pizza the night before, and his Christian influence, like, this is, hey, let's just take the first two letters of Christ's name in Greek and make this cool symbol, and I'll say, I don't know how to respond to that. It's just, to me, if you were to come up to me and say, hey, Pastor, I had this dream, and I think we ought to put up this symbol, because God told me if we use the symbol, they will come. If we build it, they will come. And we do this, I mean, I would be running from you. I mean, it's like, we're not doing that. Okay, what? I'd be skeptical, okay? And so I'm a little skeptical of exactly what it was that Constantine... He saw something, and obviously the Lord used him in a unique, I don't know if I want to say mighty way, but used him in a way that would forever influence the church. Unlike any other emperor up to this point, he forever would change the church. The church was not the same after Constantine as it was before Constantine. Is that good or bad? Yeah, it is what it is. So, I think he was a believer. He seemed to be genuinely converted, but again, I just think he was woefully educated in things theological. I mean, I don't see anything in his early influence from his father, his mother. I mean, they were pagan Romans. And so he comes to become a Christian, and again, he couldn't just say, oh, I'm a Christian, so I'm going to go run to Southern Seminary and sit under Al Mohler, or go sit under Master Seminary at John MacArthur. There wasn't that stuff. Who would you go to? How would you be educated? And he's trying to run an empire. He's having to do these battles, and he's having to concern himself with the affairs of a massive territory. And when does he find time to educate himself on theological matters? So I guess I'm trying to cut him a little slack. I mean, should he have been? He wasn't a spiritual leader. He left that to the other folks. How could he kill his son, you know, because of a military coup? I haven't read enough to know all the details to know if that was justified, if it was just out of, you know, that was not uncommon for Roman emperors to do, to kill family members if they thought they were going to try to take over, which doesn't fit our Christian, doesn't fit the biblical ideal at all. But I don't know how much did he know to you know, kind of guide him in all those things. Yeah, well, obviously, and I don't know, you sounds like you've read a little more on that than me. If his son was trying to harm his wife, he might have been justified in what he did. We just aren't given that information. So did somebody have a hand? No apostles at this point. So John would have been the last apostle, who died around 100 AD, and we're talking about 300 AD. So yeah, we're a couple of hundred years removed from the last apostle. We're also, by this time, so we had men like Ignatius and Polycarp, who were actual disciples of the apostles, who had lived into the 100s, 150, 160 AD. They're all gone. So now we don't have anybody who is directly linked to an apostle by this time. So again, yeah, the question being, maybe there should have been somebody to come alongside Constantine and teach him. And I'm sure there were some very theologically astute folks in the kingdom, but or the empire, but, I mean, how do you find them? And again, this man was, it's not like he sat around and just, what's that? Google it. Yeah, he couldn't Google his, is it okay for me to kill my son if he's harmed my wife, or is that anti-Christian? I mean, that's just didn't have those kind of things. Yes. I'm just saying, when did he have the time to sit? I mean, he obviously knew things, and he obviously brought some good things to bear. He obviously opened the door for... I guess where I kind of struggle with what Constantine did is I just don't know he was genuinely converted. If he was, which I don't have any necessarily reason to doubt that, but I just don't think he had some of the same grounding as... We're just so used to the grounding. I was interviewing some of the candidates for baptism, and of course, all the Collins kids brought up in a Christian home. They've known nothing but a Christian foundation. Travis shared his testimony, brought up in a Christian home, and even though it took a while for him to come to faith with all that, he's always had that teaching grounded in that. Constantine had nothing like that. I mean, absolutely nothing like that. It's all based on conscience, and then here he is, he comes to faith, and he's probably picking up things from these bishops, but he's not sitting around with some spiritual advisor constantly telling him what he should and shouldn't do according to Scripture. So, okay, so Constantine is justified. He's now...
Sin happens,
right? Okay. Sin happens. I mean, obviously, just looking at scriptures, we see folks doing horrific things. You know, and I would say as horrific as David's murdering of Uriah and his adulterous relationship with Bathsheba, how about the Apostle Peter himself, who actually denies the Lord Jesus three times in a public setting? And what did Jesus say? If you deny me before men, I will deny you before the Father. So which is worse? I mean, it's this guy. And yet, David found forgiveness for his sins. Peter found forgiveness for his sin. And so, again, I find it fascinating, the conversation. We're just talking about some things we can't really know. If Constantine's up there, you know, in glory, ask him, man, what were you thinking? And he'll say, I was just the dope, and I'm gloriously saved, and I'm glad that wasn't held against me. And if he's not there, well, then we'll know it was... Because he had different opportunities that things we would never experience, and those bring various temptations with it, absolutely. So, and yet, then long and the short of it is this. Constantine is just a man who seemingly came to Christ, wanted to do something that would benefit the church, and did that, but it also came at some cost to the church. It also brought some things into the church that we look back on and would say, oh, I wish that hadn't happened. Bishops having the kind of moving from being pastors to now political leaders, and we'd like to see that maybe not be so much. Yes, sir. Well, let me set the stage on this, if I can so very rapidly cover some of Roman Caesar thought. Julius Caesar, how many of you have heard of him? Julius Caesar did something that no other Caesar or Augustus would do, and that is, when he took power, he, instead of kind of being an equal among the Senate and those other folks, he began to establish himself as Lord over everybody. He made himself out to be not just kind of a son of God, which a lot of the emperors would kind of claim that ideal. He was God. Well, the Romans didn't like this. And in 44 BC, they assassinated him, a man by the name of Caesar Augustus. You've heard his name before, right? So Augustus then reestablishes what he calls the Principate, which is he is to be considered the first among equals, meaning he doesn't want himself to be seen necessarily as God over everybody. He is indeed Lord and needs to be hailed as Lord, but he depends upon those around him and he's considered simply a first among equals. That takes place in 44 BC and continues all the way until 284 AD when Diocletian comes up. Remember his name? That's what we started with. And he said, in order to establish the power of Rome again, I am not some simple co-equal Lord. I am God. And that's why he's so anti-Christian. He doesn't want any rivals, and he seeks to eliminate any religion that might ever set itself up against his deity. And that works for him for 20 years, till 305. Then everything begins to collapse. And now to your point, Peter, here comes Constantine, and rather than declare himself as God or a Lord to be worshipped, he goes into the house of worship and worships the one true God. And that is an absolutely stunning change of events. So, I mean, anyway, I don't know what we would compare it to. If President Obama, while he was president, came into our church and said, I'm repenting of my sins and I want to be changed, I want to be discipled, we would all go, what? That's a radical change of events, okay? That's what took place. Who was? Well, and that's what I'm saying. We don't know the circumstances. Was it because if his son was trying to rape his wife, I mean, okay, then we would say he's probably justified. I don't know. I haven't read that much. Roman, the political and what's the word I'm looking for? The political, social. I was thinking more of the soap opera of the of the Romans. That stuff just kind of gets old to me because they're always killing one another off and the relationships they have. And it's not one of my. It's not what I just say. I'd like to read some. I'm going to go read some ancient Roman politics and social things going on. So anyway, all of this set the stage for us now to see the church begin to flourish in a way it had not flourished before. Again, the question is always going to be, was this for the good or was this for the bad? We're going to see some good things. The church being able to actually meet out in the open and discuss deep theological issues like Arianism. And is Jesus Christ truly God in the flesh? And what is the relationship of God to the Father to the Son and the Spirit to the Father and the Son? And establish the doctrines of the Trinity, not discover them, but simply articulate them in a way that Scripture reveals. That's what they were doing at this time. And there's no time like it. There's just no time like it. You want to know why we believe so many of the things we believe? It's because it's in the Bible, but it was first articulated. It was first given to us in a theological form that we could process by these folks that are living between 325 and 380 in the first and second councils of Nicaea. And so that's just fascinating. So why do we believe some of the things we believe? We believe it because it's biblical. But again, just like sometimes I'll preach something, you'll come up to me, I'd never thought about it that way, Pastor. That just really clarified this particular issue for me. It's not that I invented it. It's just that I put it in a way that helps us understand it verbally. That's what these councils were trying to do. What does the Bible say? Let's put it in words that our people can understand. And that's, again, gave rise to the creeds, which we will talk about sometime next week. So, anything else? We're really at the end of our time here. Really appreciate the input and hope that you will be encouraged. The hand of God upon His church. The gates of hell will not prevail against it. So let's close in prayer and we will wrap things up. Heavenly Father, we do thank you for your hand in history. And Father God, we recognize that if you were not the God of history, we wouldn't be here. That you are the God who sent your Son Jesus Christ to die on the cross for our sins, to be raised on the third day, and we know that's in history. You established your church, that's in history. You've given theology and the Word of God to the church, that is part of our history. You've protected your church through the ages, that is part of our history. And even we who are here, if we have proclaimed faith in your Son Jesus Christ, it is because of something that took place in history. You are the God who providentially brought us to the very moments and to the very people that would share the gospel by which we would believe on the Lord Jesus Christ. So help us to find great joy and just to be grateful that you are the God who has worked behind the scenes and sometimes right out in the open, as it were, with regard to preserving and protecting your church. And may we be a people who, because of these things, recognize our continued role. We have but one mission, to go and make disciples, learners of Jesus Christ. And may we do that to your glory and to the building up of your church as we await your kingdom as we ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.